Well, we left the book of Esther with Esther heeding the advice of Mordecai to go into the king, which is against the law, and to plead for the life of her people. And you'll remember at the end of chapter 4, she famously says, "If I perish, I perish." And to prepare, right, she had called for a three-day fast of all the Jews in the capital city of Susa. And the narrative, as we come to the crux of the book here, it slows down dramatically. Nearly 9 years have gone by from the opening of the book to this point. Right? The crucial turning in the story over the next couple of chapters takes place in a mere 2 days. So you've got 9 years and then boom, 2 days. It's like a slow motion shot. A slow motion act of heroism. Chapter 5, which is our text, takes less than a full day. And so we'll make 2 points here. They're on page 8, the outline in your bulletin. Esther's wisdom and Haman's folly. So first, Esther's wisdom. It's already been, we learned, right, 30 days since Esther saw the king. So that goes back even before the decree to slaughter the Jews was issued. She's not been in the king's chambers. On the third day of the feast, we're told, that the day which echoes, the third day, it echoes with divine deliverance, Esther must now be wondering, am I going to be like a lamb led to the slaughter? She summons up her courage. And on the third day, we're told she puts on her royal robes. She comes now, right, not as a beauty queen, but as the queen of Persia. Not merely attractive, but clothed in her royal stature. She has literally, the text says, put her royalty on. She has, as Mordecai suggested, come into the kingdom, into her royal station for this appointed time. And the whole ambiance here inside the palace is one of intimidating royal majesty. Words related to king or kingdom are used 6 times in the first verse to give you a sort of a feel for this. And Esther comes into this ambiance, and the text says she stands. She does not bow, she stands. She's the queen of Persia. She stands in the inner court in front of the king's quarters, which is against the law, and it is done under the threat of death. There are reliefs, paintings from this period, which show the Persian king on his throne. And he has a soldier with an axe by his side to prevent unwanted intrusions. So the king is sitting on his royal throne. He's facing the entrance, and he sees Esther. Esther, who the narrator calls for the first time in the book, Queen Esther. She's been Esther to this point. She's queen now. And to her great relief, he was pleased with her, or he favored her, and he holds out the golden scepter. Right? Thus, for now, lifting the death sentence. She approaches, she touches the scepter, which is a sign of submission to the king. And the king, who's a little bit slow on the uptake sometimes, but he could tell by looking at Esther that something's not right. He knows the risk she took to come see him. So he asks her, "What is it?" Or something like, "What's up with you?" And notice, he calls her Queen Esther. "What's up with you, Queen Esther?" So now the narrator and Ahasuerus both agree. Esther is royalty. And one of the things that's happening is she is rising in status. And she is rising in dignity and authority as the chapter unfolds. What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? Even up to the half of the kingdom, it will be given to you. This is, of course, standard court protocol hyperbole. The king isn't giving away half his kingdom, right? But it does mean something like, hey, I'm in a generous mood. What is it you want? Try me. And we'll see shortly that even Esther doesn't take the invitation literally. She doesn't ask him for half the kingdom. You would think, though, that having escaped the death sentence and having been given this kind of open door to make her request, that and having been charged by Mordecai to make the request, right, that Esther would lay the petition before the king immediately. And surprisingly, that's not what happens. Instead, she exercises what I've called here strategic patience. And this allows the tension to mount in the story. This is a very dangerous game she's playing, right? Because the king has given her a lot of rope. Now the question is, will she hang herself with it or not? The narrator, and you should be used to this by now, the narrator, of course, doesn't tell us why she refuses to be direct or why she chooses the course of action she does. And some commentators think that this means we shouldn't speculate. I think the opposite. I think the narrator's silence is an invitation to ask why. Why this way? Why at this time? And as we've seen, I think a large portion of the book is meant to produce reflection on tactics, on strategy, on timing, on prudence, on human psychology in a political world. All right, a world where, though it is never stated, God's providential hand is assumed, but almost always invisible. What kind of human actions do we take in that world under that kind of God? Right? Some people want to have a word from God for everything they do. Right? Turns out that's a form of immaturity. Right? This is a form of maturity, to be able to act wisely and prudently and justly with discernment in a world of ambiguity, in a world where you know it's governed by the providence of God, but you can't read the providence of God like you might read the newspaper. When do we resist? When do we conform? When do we block? When do we subvert? When do we delay? When do we stand and fight? Right? The book then is pushing back against a cookie-cutter view of life, a cookie-cutter view of political action, of what it means to be a human agent when you are in the realm of permanent exile, which is the realm that the people of God were existing in here in Persia, and it's the realm that 1 Peter says Christians live in. So, Esther, she knows that the king, she knows that Ahasuerus doesn't care much about the actual substance of the policy to kill the Jews. Remember, he barely paid attention to it when Haman proposed it. He didn't even ask, remember, who are these people? She hadn't heard of it. Esther hadn't heard of it inside the palace until Mordecai brought it to her attention. So what she needs to do is she needs to damage Haman's credibility. Right? She needs to undermine his standing with the king somehow. And that's not easy. She needs another voice, her voice, to be heard over against Haman's voice. And this is tricky because she's not going to beat Haman on policy credibility. Like, her policy credibility is not going to prevail against his. She knows that the king is mercurial, but he changes a lot. He changes quickly. She knows he's pliable in the hands of his advisors. So there are real drawbacks to taking up the king's generous offer to present her request. I mean, these drawbacks would probably exist no matter when she did it. But these are the big drawbacks. First, her Jewishness, and thus her deceit of the king, would be exposed. And second, don't forget this, because she hasn't forgotten this. The law cannot be changed anyway. Right? Even if the king were open to her, he would be in a legal bind. He's not likely to want to lose face. But most importantly, I think, here is that if Haman is not involved and confronted from the moment of Esther's request, and remember, Haman is not present here, right? If he's not there, then, you know, the king could likely change his mind in a subsequent meeting. Haman could go in with some advisors to the king and just change his mind, a meeting at which Esther would be absent. So she clearly wants him in the room when she undoes the plan. So she has a plan, which is not obvious. It's not direct. She's exercising strategic patience. She's no longer the tool of Mordecai. She's her own tactician. And it's quite possible, we would think it's even probable, right, that she conceived this plan during the 3-day fast, which has just preceded this time. If it please the king, she says, let the king and Haman come today, notice that, for a feast that I have prepared for the king. I mean, that's a strange request, right? It's certainly not the request Mordecai asked her to make. Nor is it the kind of request that the king invited her to make. He's in the mood for a grand gesture, and she invites him. She decides, this will be my grand gesture. I'm going to invite you, who I haven't seen for 30 days, to a quiet dinner for 3 and some servants. This is called taking the long road home. But notice her confidence. I want you to note this. Her trust that she would be spared because she invites the king and Haman to a banquet today. That means a banquet that's already prepared, which means she was overseeing the preparation of the banquet while she was still fasting. It's like watching the Food Channel while you're fasting. But she knows the king, and she wants him relaxed, and she wants him drinking. And she wants Haman in the room so she can act like some kind of a wedge to pry their bond apart. Besides, in this culture, as in many cultures, right, in preparing and serving a meal, that gives the hostess a certain leverage over the proceedings. So the king's all in on this plan. He's in on it. He's thinking, I gave her up to half my kingdom. She's giving me a dinner. I mean, who wouldn't take that offer? And so he says, bring Haman quickly so that we may do what Esther has asked. Now, don't let that sentence slide by, right? At the end of the last chapter, Esther was issuing commandments and Mordecai and the Jews in Susa were obeying. And here, the king and Haman are to do what Esther asks. So again, her word is gaining authority. She's subtly changing the psychological disposition of the king. And she's subtly changing the balance of power in the situation. For now, it's soft power. So the king and Haman, they go to the banquet that Esther had prepared. And as she wanted, they're drinking. So the king asks her again, for a second time. Right, surely this banquet is not what you were wishing for. What is your wish, even up to the half of my kingdom? It will be granted. Now we have to wonder here, right? Any reader of the story's got to wonder, does Esther falter here? Is this plan, does she hesitate or stammer, or does she change her mind, or does she decide she's not willing to take the risk? Does she lose her nerve? Because shockingly, her best idea at this point seems to be, let's have a second feast tomorrow. I mean, just think about it, right? Somebody you work with says, I want to take you out for a cup of coffee or dinner tonight. I need to talk to you. And they take you out to dinner, and at the dinner they say, look, here's what I wanted to say. Let's have another dinner tomorrow night. You'd be like, that would be unnerving, right? That would send some real signals to you. That's what's going on here. It's an extremely dangerous game that she's playing. She risks spoiling the king's magnanimous mood. And she gives occasion even for Haman to figure out something must be going on here. But you know how she does it? She puts this request forward with great flourish and with great meekness. In short, what she does is she panders. She knows the king likes to be flattered, so she mentions that the king is king 4 times. If I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my wish, let the king and Haman come to the feast that I prepare for them, and then tomorrow I will do as the king said. King, 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 king. And so I think part of what she's done craftily, by, you know, she's trying to restrain his impulsiveness with some suspense, Essentially, she's prepping him to answer yes in advance. These banquets are semi-public banquets, right? The king has already offered twice in the semi-public situation to grant her request. There are witnesses. By tomorrow's banquet, it will be three times. So psychologically, she's making it harder and harder for the king to show up, hear the offer, you know, repeat the offer to Esther, and then say no. So that's her wisdom. You got Mordecai's public pressure out there in the square in sackcloth and ashes. To that public pressure, she adds quiet behind-the-scenes diplomacy. So the second thing to look at is Haman here, Haman's folly. He goes out in verse 9. This is from the first banquet, right? He goes out in verse 9, happy and high in spirit, some translations say. Joyful and glad of heart. That's the effect of social prestige and alcohol. But in his joy, this Haman is a fool. And Mordecai is still at the gate. And Mordecai ups the ante here. He not only refuses to bow, he shows no lesser signs of respect either. He won't rise, he won't tremble, he doesn't even stand. So the decree of annihilation has not lessened Mordecai's contempt, it's only strengthened it. Now, if you're Haman, he's thinking this Mordecai guy is an uncontrolled menace. He's giving me post-banquet indigestion. He's disturbing to Haman. And this is key, right? Public respect, as it is for so many politicians and public figures, is an idol for Haman. So he's enraged, right? And disproportionate anger is always a sign that an idol is threatened. Right, this guy has one of the highest, best paid, most powerful positions in the world, and he is enraged that one person does not tremble in his presence. Disproportionate anger is a sign that your idols are threatened. But for now, Haman restrains himself. He goes home, and he calls together some friends and his wife, Zeresh. And this is a textbook example of pride going before destruction. Right? The viciousness of pride, the insidiousness of it. In verse 11, we're told, Haman boasted to them about his vast wealth. He recounted to them the splendors of his riches. His many sons, all the promotions with which the king honored him, and how he advanced him above all the officials and servants of the king. I mean, you talk about a narcissistic, self-absorbed fool. Right, this politician. Do you know what this guy never says when he gets home? How was your day? He has an evening gathering with his friends and his wife just to boast. It's just a boasting forum. How many times do you think these people have had to listen to this? Right? Just to listen to how rich I am. I'm rich. I'm really, 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 really rich. Like they wouldn't know how rich he is. You think this guy's wife doesn't know how many sons he has? Says he boasted about his sons. That's true. They might not all be hers, but I think she'd know the rough number. I'm really, really rich. I got all my family's fantastic. My sons are just great. Or what about his promotions at work? He boasts about his rise to the top. Do you they didn't know? Like, do you think he's been quiet about it before? Do you think he's been getting promotions for the last 7 or 8 years and not telling anybody? No, he's a narcissist. This is an epic level of juvenile self-absorption. I'm really, really rich. I'm really, really great. I've really, really, really been promoted a lot. Right? This is a hollow and highly successful man. And as such, he's blind. He says, I'm the only person, not the third wheel, right? He doesn't see himself as the third wheel in the banquet. He sees himself as the only person, Queen Esther. Even Haman is calling her Queen Esther now. I'm the only one she invited to the banquet for the king. Nobody but me. And she's invited me to another banquet tomorrow, also with the king. He doesn't sniff anything out of order. How could he? All he sees is himself. And yet, he continues, you'll see this in the text, all of this is worth nothing to me as long as I see Mordecai the Jew. There's that Amalekite anti-Semitism again. The Jew sitting at the king's gate. So fools have this problem. Their highs are too high. I'm rich. I'm having a banquet with the king. And their lows are too low. There's one guy at the gate and that destroys my whole world. There's just one guy. So you know what his wife and his friends convince him to do? They convince him to construct a ludicrously high 75-foot gallows to hang Mordecai on. Right? Geniuses attract geniuses. We're going to build a gallows, a big, beautiful gallows. It's going to be the biggest, best gallows you've ever seen. It's going to be 75 feet high, which means it's an image of Haman's absurdly inflated ego. Right, this, of course, it'd be higher than the palace. Think about that. The gallows would be taller than the palace that the king lives in. It's horrific counsel. It's not about mortifying your idolatry. Right, the friends and the wife, they're about feeding the guy's idolatry. The guy's conception of his own greatness. But look, if you build a gallows that big, you're going to broadcast that resistance to Haman is futile. And apparently, this is urgent. It can't wait for the decree 11 months from now to annihilate all the Jews. The gallows has to be set up tonight, now, so the king can sentence Mordecai to death on it in the morning. And then his wife and friends say this, then you can go to the banquet and enjoy yourself. Right? There's nothing like a post-execution meal. So again, like Adam and Eve, who could eat from every tree but one, that wasn't good enough. Haman can live with adulation from all subjects but one. He can't live that way. Like all power mongers, he obsesses over the lone dissenter, the one advisor who critiques them, the one ex-cabinet member who writes a book or whatever, right? It just destroys these kinds of people. They have to be disowned. They have to be attacked. He needs absolute loyalty. You know what he doesn't have? What Lincoln had in his cabinet, right? A team of rivals. Because Lincoln was secure and had some humility, right? So he had in his cabinet men who he knew would disagree with him. Strong, intelligent people so they could fight it out. Because that's what adults do. They don't get a cabinet of sycophants and then disown them if one of them dissents or disagrees from you. It's an extremely narcissistic, juvenile way to be a leader. Imagine if American presidents of either party could just gather a cabinet where they had voices from outside their own echo chambers in the cabinet. It's like trying to imagine some sort of alternative universe. So not only does this guy only have one set of voices that he listens to, when someone dissents, he needs them killed. So this suggestion of building a 75-foot-high gallows and executing this one guy by tomorrow morning, surprise, surprise, it pleases Haman. And he has the gallows set up. It's ironic, of course, the irony is only noticed by the narrator and by us if we pay attention, right? The original decree against the original Queen Vashti was so that every man could rule in his house. And here the prime minister is being ruled by the foolish counsel of his wife and friends. And now, though, Esther's plan looks exposed. It looks like she made a tactical mistake in asking for the second dinner, doesn't it? By tomorrow night's banquet, Mordecai may be dead. So asking for that second banquet, probably not a great idea. And his public protests and her quiet diplomacy, they don't seem like a good match now. They seemed like a good match a half an hour ago. They're exposed now. So either the night will do its work to intervene, and what a night this will be. Lord willing, we'll look at it in chapter 6 next week. Either the night will do its work, or Esther will confront Haman with a dead stepfather. So let me conclude with three takeaways for us. I think the passage is surprisingly relevant. The first one is prayer. When we face crises, right, we should imitate Esther here, whether a personal or political crisis. We should slow down. Remember, she takes 3 days. She slow down and wait on the Lord. Right? We should fast and we should pray. Right? Is there a political crisis or a social crisis or a national crisis? How about 3 days of silence, just fast and pray? We must not forget the 3 days before this scene. It doesn't say they pray, that's true, but they very likely did, and we certainly should. This is a key part in trusting the Lord with all our hearts and not leaning on our own self-understanding, but in all of our ways acknowledging God so that He could direct our paths. Right? It's part of strategic patience, is to stop and pray. Right? We're to be anxious for nothing, Paul says, right? But with prayer and supplication, together with thanksgiving, make our requests known to God. That's the first lesson here, and it's a good lesson. We ought not to rush into things and assume we know what we're doing. The second thing is providence. We say this every week now, I guess, but when we face unpredictable or proud or volatile or difficult people, we have to remember Proverbs 21:1, right? The king's heart is a stream of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he wills. Right? And if it's true of kings, and it is, then it's true of people in our lives whose hearts need to be opened or softened or enlightened or comforted or turned. Right? Trust the God who, unlike the Persian king, has an open door policy. Right? Our God has an open door policy. You can approach him with confidence and with boldness because someone has already passed under the scepter of judgment, Jesus Christ. Right? You have to trust that providence, even in the hour of darkness, even in the hour of threat. So prayer, providence, and finally, the third thing is patience or strategic patience. Learning to see that that's a virtue is really, really important. You know when we found out that we don't have this kind of wisdom and discernment? During COVID. We certainly had this. We certainly had two sides. One side thought this is the right way to approach it, and the other side saw this is the right way to approach it. But the book of Esther would give us a certain kind of humility to realize tactics are really tough. Like exactly when to obey the state, exactly when to resist the state, exactly when to do. But we didn't have any sense of that, right? Everyone's going around with some chest-thumping self-righteousness. We have to do this because if we don't do this, then this will happen and that will happen. I personally think a lot of that stuff looks ridiculous 5 years on. Because what it was a tactical discussion, right? About exactly what the church can do and exactly what the state can do. And on tactical discussions, there can be some differences. You don't want to give up on any principles, but often we assume some grand principle is at stake when it's not. But the point is, we have to cultivate this. You could even disagree with what I just said. I'm sure some of you do. But the point is, having strategic patience is a virtue, right? Knowing exactly what's at stake, right? So you could have two very, very good brothers or sisters in Christ. They could have disagreed on this thing. But try saying that in 2020. So strategic patience has to be cultivated. True, it can never replace courage, but Esther's already demonstrated courage. Right? This is not wimpiness. It's just figuring out how to tactically enact my courage. And a key part in Esther becoming a sage is she's learning the arts of indirection and of subtlety and of meekness with people, of strategic patience, of playing the long game, of mastering the art of political tactics. So we see all three of these things, by the way. All three. Prayer, a trust in providence, and strategic patience perfectly integrated in our Lord's life. Right? He prayed fervently and frequently, especially before big decisions. He's going to choose the apostles. He prays all night. Right? He's going to Gethsemane. He's praying there. At the big moments, he would recede into the wilderness and pray. He prayed repeatedly for his Father's direction. Now, if he has to do that as the incarnate Son, how much more do we need to do that? The second thing he did was he trusted the hidden providence of his Father to turn the hearts of kings to him, to fulfill the divine purpose for which he was sent. Right? He made this very clear to Herod. He said to Herod, "You don't have any authority over me except what has been given to you from above." He didn't need to fight. His disciples don't need to take up the sword. His father's in control of these things. The third thing he did was he showed strategic patience. One of the things Jesus repeatedly says in the Gospels, especially John's Gospel, is, "My hour has not yet come. My hour has not yet come." Or he'll heal someone and say, "I don't want you to tell anybody about this." Like, he recognizes the time, right? He recognizes, he'll say to the disciples, "I have many things to tell you, but you can't bear them now." He doesn't say, "Look, this is the principle, get in line." He realizes, well, this is not going to work right now. Maybe 6 or 8 months from now we can do this with the disciples. I can't do it with them now. Right? So he's doing this all the time. His whole life is an exercise in courageous, strategic patience. Sometimes he deflects when the Pharisees ask him stuff. Sometimes he eviscerates them. But he's not always in the same mode. And part of the mode he's in depends on the situation and where he is in his ministry and how far away he is from the passion. So there's a tremendous example there for the Christian life cannot be reduced to a handful of principles that just get enacted all the time. If you do that, you're going to run over the top of people. And then Jesus, who showed us all three things. He showed us prayer, he showed us a trust in providence, and he showed us strategic patience. Through his public gallows, he brings about the reversal. The great reversal, of which the reversal which is about to take place in the book of Esther is but a foretaste. Right? He died the just for the unjust, the innocent for the guilty, the wise for fools, that he might bring us rescued and welcomed into his Father's kingly throne room. Right? And so we give all glory to Christ, the King, the Savior, and the Sage. Amen.